Hey, listeners, welcome back to the Wellness Wisdom Podcast. We are glad you are here listening with us today. And today we are going to talk about a very important subject, brain health. And the brain is not a static set organ that can only degrade as we age. And the neuroplasticity is your brain's ability to change in response to experience. So when we seek and find neuroplasticity opportunities, this is going to help provide us with a denser brain concentration of cells that have stronger, faster connections between those cells. And so many people today are seeing their parents with Parkinson's, with Alzheimer's, with vascular neurodevelopmental diseases, you know, more and more and more. And we're having people who are living older than 65 now, but they're in their 80s and they have these dementia, Alzheimer's and things like that, that they're struggling with. So it's not a quality of life that they're having, you know, with these older ages now. And all of us here on the podcast today, we have experience with family members who are going through that or have gone through that. So we really wanted to bring this subject to the table and talk about it in multiple different valleys here. So we're going to talk about several different things. I just want to remind everybody that with all the information that you do here in our podcast, any episode you listen to, it is for educational purposes only. And before making any changes in your diet, lifestyle, supplements, or anything like that, we ask that you please have a conversation with your medical licensed professional first. So today, let's introduce the coaches that we've got on the panel today. Tracy Guerrero, welcome.
Thank you. I'm excited about today's topic.
Yes, me too. Kathy Riley, welcome.
Hi, thank you. Good to be here.
Bobby McGrath.
Hello, hello.
Michelle McCoy.
Hi there.
And lastly, but not least, Jane Phillips.
Pleasure to be here, everybody.
And I am your host, Shannon Spears. Again, welcome to the Wellness Wisdom Podcast. Okay, so the first section I'm going to talk about today, obviously, is cognitive aging and memory. So we want to really kind of explore the natural cognitive aging process and how that can affect memory. So who wants to start?
Well, I thought I'd throw out something that was in one of the studies that we're going to talk about later, just to kind of start this ball rolling. In the Frontier study that we're going to talk about, they predicted in 2050 that there will be a doubling of the older population. And that the largest, fastest growing population was the 80-year-olds. And it went on to kind of talk a little bit about the burden that that will put on our world, basically. You know, not having enough assisted living places, not having enough care providers, we're struggling right now to handle the right type of dementia care and neurological disorders and things like that, that type of care. And the stress that it puts on the families is enormous. And I know that a lot of us here on the panel have experienced that. And so I think today's episode is going to be great for people to learn that the brain is not unchangeable. There's things that we're going to talk about that's going to improve it. There's things you need to be aware of. There's things that people probably haven't ever had come across their radar, like high toxin levels can actually mimic Alzheimer's and dementia, and things you can actually put into play and do in your life now versus wait until you get a diagnosis and then go, oh yeah, I probably should clean up my act a little bit or exercise or eat better. So I just wanted to throw that out to get us rolling with that.
Thank you for that, Bobby. I can throw in some research, a recent research study that came out that's kind of exciting around this for us all. The researchers were hoping to bring an MRI biomarker to dementia risk stratification in patient care and clinical trials. And it seems like a thinning of a brain region may actually signal dementia risk 5 to 10 years before the symptomology actually appears. So that's really exciting. Like if we could, it's the cortical gray matter in our brain and the thickness of it apparently is the marker that they identified. And this was a pretty good study. They studied 1,000 Massachusetts participants and 500 people from a California cohort over a 10-year period. And it was a vast representation. The biggest interest in the paper is, like I said, the cortical gray matter thickness will be a marker that can be used to identify people at high risk of dementia. I don't know if we've ever had anything like that out there where we can actually firmly say that, yes, this matter looks thick with an MRI and you need to be concerned about this and start taking steps now. And if we can start detecting the disease early, we're in a better time frame for therapeutic interventions and certainly lifestyle modifications, right?
I love that. I thought that was an awesome study that you sent, Tracy, or that you showed us, because I kind of feel like if people have the early warning signs, then they get to choose.
Exactly.
Right? It's when they didn't really understand or know or didn't look at their family history, and it's too, I don't want to say too late, but they're so far down the road that they've got a long way to come back, and they're going to have deficits that they just can't repair. But hopefully today we'll encourage you all through the things we're going to share that there is ways to change that. But I thought that was great to have some form of hope of there isn't, quote, an Alzheimer's study, but if there's something that is a marker, like let's test the marker when you're 40 or 30,
correct?
You know?
Correct. And really interesting, Bobby, they actually looked at the APOE4, which is a main genetic factor related to dementia, and it wasn't related to the gray matter thickness at all. I mean, we all think genetics, but this was totally separate in and of itself. So the genetic marker didn't necessarily correspond with what they were finding in the study, which I found interesting. Just because that we might have that in our family, with Alzheimer's, dementia, all the things, and we're saying that we might have the genetic marker for it, there's other things that we can be looking at that apparently are more accurate as far as your risk factor for developing it. Very cool.
Yeah, and I think it's important to point out here too, is that while genetics don't really have a whole lot to do with it, your epigenetics mm-hmm. have been studied and shown that they do have quite a bit to do with that. So your epigenetics, for our audience, epigenetics are the environmental factors that are going to trigger something in your genetics that changes quickly. You know, it can change genetically in your body, how things are happening, how new genes are being expressed over a short period of time versus DNA takes years and years and multiple generations to change. So epigenetics are those quick changing genetics that are influenced by food, by lifestyle, by environmental toxins and things like that. So that does make a big difference. And we're going to talk about that a little bit later as we go down. So go ahead, Kathy.
Oh, I was just going to say, you know, y'all talking about this, you know, I wanted to look up and see what type of testing there is available because testing the gray matter is very, you know, it's fascinating. But it looks like the Alzheimer's testing is a physical exam, diagnostic tests, neurological exam, mental status tests, and brain imaging such as a CAT scan, MRI, or PET. And then there's also, it says that there's a blood test that can detect traces of certain proteins that are known to develop in Alzheimer's patients. So I thought that was fascinating. And just, I was curious how they determine, you know, test the cortical gray matter that Tracy was discussing. So I just wanted to dig that up a little bit.
How they tested it?
Yeah.
That's asking.
Yeah, it may not say in the study there.
It did not go into that, but it's certainly a study that I want to continue to follow because it gave a lot of identifying markers, and I think this is just really promising for the future and what this might hold for some of us, because all of us are thinking about that at this point, right? Because of our environmental factors and because of our food and because of all the things happening right now in the world. It's certainly something to be very cognizant of.
Right. And to your point, too, like there's hope. There's always hope that there are things that we can do to change you know, our lifestyle factors, our habits, our sleep, our stress levels, our nutrition, all of that plays a huge, huge part into, and this would be the time, right? I mean, like, we're all here in midlife, but even if you are in your 30s, like, this is a time for you to be aware that your lifestyle choices play later on into what can happen, not just in your body, but in your brain as well. So there's always a choice to choose a healthier path so that you can help ward some of these symptoms off.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it's really important to, I mean, we all worry about, because we've seen someone in our family, we've seen our parents who have gone through it, are currently going through it, you know, and we think about it. I don't think, unless you've been personally impacted with having to take care of somebody or having those conversations with somebody who has dementia or Alzheimer's and realizing the decline that happens in a person, I don't think it really affects you. You know, like, you hear about it, but until you have that personal connection and see it and have to go through it, like, it doesn't really become that important to you, right? You just say, well, you know, everybody ages, everybody has different problems when they age. Some of the studies that I was looking at, and I know, Bob, you had put in some studies on cognitive training and aging. And some of the ones that I had looked up in addition to that were also talking about how, instead of now just focusing on older generations, those who may be 50 and older, we also need to focus on children, because of all of the environmental factors that are being now studied and shown to have those long-term effects. So they may be fine all the way up until age 45 or so, and then all of a sudden those slow cognitive declines start coming in because they're eating processed food their entire life, or they were sedentary, had a sedentary lifestyle, or they gained a massive amount of weight and lost a massive amount of weight. Like, all of these they're starting to find in studies are now contributive to the loss of cognitive ability in the brain. So, you know, of course, when we look at some of the things that help older people, you know, like, they're 60 and above, you know, my dad is one of them, my sister's mother-in-law, like, all of these things, that doing like brain training apps and stuff, right? Which, and a lot of people go, well, you know, if our kids are playing video games, they should be fine by the time they get older, right? But they just need to continue doing that. It's not how that works. There's a different kind of stress that's put on the brain, right? But the fact that there are, that this is something that is coming along quickly, really. I mean, the advancements that have happened with brain health studies and cognitive ability studies over the last 5 years or so have just, I mean, they keep coming and coming and coming, and there's a lot that's being done. So much more than just doing a brain app, right?
Yep. And also one of the studies was talking about multiple, like, assessments, because I don't know about you, but I think we all have discerning eyes as health coaches. I live on a park and I see people walk all day long in the park with their dog and move around and things like that. And it's just my nature to watch their walk, watch their gait. How are they moving? Are they moving, you know, their arms and legs, or do they have like a funny kind of hitch in their gait, or, you know, do they walk with their arms out wide or their legs out wide, things like that. And those are kinds of things that a lot of people don't think about as they're, let's say, watching our parents go through their later lives and things like that, and picking up on, you know, balance was one of the biggest things that starts to decline when you're having an aging brain, but not just memory. And we all know memory is part of an aging brain, but we're talking like memory that, you know, when they're repeating stories and things like that, people are kind of like, oh, that's just who they are. That's just what they do. And it's like, no, that's actually a cognitive decline kind of signal when somebody continues not to remember certain things. You know, we all forget our keys and misplace things, but when it's more prevalent, that's when you can kind of tell that the person is struggling. Smells is a big thing too. Not being able to recognize certain smells, balance, like I said. And then if someone's had a history of like car accidents or injuries, or especially concussions, my family, unfortunately, All of my kids have had multiple concussions. My husband's had a couple as an adult, and I know he did when he was younger. Those all add up. And one of the things I learned in a brain training course that I took was that your brain has the memory from that injury. And so when you get a second injury and a third injury to your brain, it remembers that and kind of quickly inflames even faster. So those are kinds of things I just wanted to kind of throw out as we're going through our tips that we're going to share with you guys today to kind of start to keep a track of your own self, you know, your injuries. I know about you guys, but I didn't ride a bike when I was little with a helmet on. You just did not see that, right?
No. Why would we do that?
Yeah. And I don't know what you guys were like, but I mean, when the scooter craze came out, when my kids were young, we were like, yeah, you need to put your helmet on for that. And I remember people laughing at us like, are you kidding me? He's riding a scooter. I'm like, he could take a header on the sidewalk just as easy with his scooter versus his bike or his skateboard.
Yeah. But it's like right now, like I wouldn't tell my kids or any smaller kids to drink from the hose because of all the chemicals in there versus when we were growing up, you could drink from the hose. Like it was fine, you know?
All the time.
Well, we thought it was fine. We don't really know that, do we? But we're all sitting here today.
But one thing Bobby said a moment ago was talking about the concussions or TBIs, traumatic brain injuries. And there's actually studies showing that if you have a traumatic brain injury, it also affects your microbiome. I mean, it tanks it immediately as soon as you have that TBI. So that's something that a lot of people aren't aware of. So you definitely want to take keep an eye on your gut as well if you have something like a concussion or a TBI.
That makes perfect sense. It makes perfect sense because your neurotransmitters are created in your gut, you know, and if you have a huge stress to the body, one of the first things that is attacked is your gut health, you know? So when it's that HPA axis, you know, between your gut and your brain. And when you talk about TBIs, right? Like you're also talking about PTSD. We have military veterans. You know, they have had concussions, they've had TBIs, even the mental capacity of PTSD, that's all roped into that as well. And having PTSD is also going to contribute to early onset dementia, things like that. And I never connected those two things until we were at a doctor's appointment and had testing and everything done for my dad at the VA because he has PTSD, severe PTSD. You know, that's one of the connections, you know, research.
But it's not only the HPA axis, it's actually the gut-brain connection, because the gut and the brain as a fetus, it's actually the same matter, the same tissue. And as it develops and the vagus nerve connects it, it's actually a two-way communication between the gut and the brain, and the vagus nerve is the telephone cord, per se, right. Between those two. So that's why you have the dysbiosis occur immediately with the TBI.
That is fascinating, Kathy. I'm sitting here thinking like from when I fell off a horse years ago and I had such a severe concussion, I blacked out and it took me a year to recover from that. I had some other things going on too. And I'm just like thinking back, how was my gut health during that time? Because it was a severe injury. That's fascinating. I didn't even put that connection together.
Oh yeah.
A lot of people, after they have, there's concussion protocols. And one of the ones is having a high omega fatty acids, which I know Jane, I think you're going to talk about. But there's certain things you can do for brain injuries, so that you can slow down or mitigate that open gut, which occurs. I don't think they really know what happens when you get a brain injury, why your gut opens, but your gut gets leaky. And it's like, that's the last thing you need is an open gut when your brain, you know, has been damaged.
Well, and I have living proof of that in my family with my oldest son. He was born 6 weeks premature and at age 12 was diagnosed with a traumatic brain injury from lack of oxygen at birth. He was pronounced dead three times in the first 10 days. So, you know, we experienced a lot of issues with leaky gut and, you know, different nutritional deficiencies that we couldn't figure out. And of course, this was, he was born 28 years ago. So, you know, they didn't have all the research and science, and we didn't have integrative medicine or functional medicine back then either. It was all me trying to do research, find research, change different things with him to figure out kind of what was going on and digging in and learning about different supplements and everything. So, you know, even at age 12, like there still wasn't a lot of this out there. They were just starting to come out with things like brain SPECT imaging and understanding what's going on between the two of these things. But it wasn't set in stone at that time. So to have all of this now, no matter what the age is, but connecting these dots is so important. And I'm so glad that we're getting this message out today in this episode.
Does anybody kind of know what the gold standard is for testing around it?
As far as just like aging?
Yeah, well, the brain health, and like if you suspect that somebody close to you might be in early stages of dementia, what would be that first step?
Typically, you see a neurologist, and they usually do a verbal mini mental test where they ask you, you know, remember these three words, and I'm going to come back to it in, you know, X amount of minutes, and, you know, what's the day, what's the year, I mean, all that kind of stuff. And I remember sitting at Rush University with my mom and my dad and having them do a mini mental on my mom. And we knew, you know, obviously we knew something was wrong. Why would we take her there? But when she blew through this mini mental and did not do well at all,
right,
my mouth just hit the floor. I mean, didn't know the season, didn't know that, you know, certain things like the president and the year, but she was confident. I mean, she said her stuff. She was like, oh yeah, it's 19, whatever. And I just kind of was blown away by it. And I think sometimes it's, you can see things on an MRI and different things and SPECT scans, but sometimes it's just watch how the person lives and walks and talks and, you know, can they, you know, do complicated tasks, you know, things like that. Can they do things like that? But to be honest, Tracy, I think there's so many brain clinics that are coming, you know, coming to different areas where you can work with actual places that, I mean, in reality, because we're aging so fast, these places are going to have to catch up, you know, being able to assess these older adults.
It's just, yeah, you talked about that. My dad was in the same situation. He actually passed from a glioblastoma tumor, and he was given that same, you know, set of questions asked. What do you remember? What day is it? You know, who's the president? All the things. But, you know, around Alzheimer's and dementia specifically, I mean, he did really well in parts of the test. And then other ones were like, he really had to sit there and think about it. And my dad was a brilliant man, so we knew, you know, something was off. But that was tumor related, not necessarily dementia, Alzheimer's related. So just curious as to what, if they have even identified a gold standard in, you know, diagnosing Alzheimer's dementia.
Yeah, I think it comes down to more than like the neuropsychological tests, verbal tests that they do. And until they progress further, and then they will do more tests. In my experience with my dad, like we had to keep track of things he was doing. My sister lives closer to him. So she would keep track of things that were going on in his apartment and things like that, and conversations she would have with him. I would keep track of conversations I would have with him. She would also note when they were at other appointments, you know, his need to continually tell the same things over and over and over again. And also his demeanor, his personality, you know, changed dramatically. Like I was in one of the appointments when I was out there, and, you know, ask those questions, remember these three words, this and that. And at the end, like he struggled to remember them. But then she asked him a couple of other things at that point of, you know, well, what's today's date? What's this with that? And he was like, he could say that. And so she was like, okay, you're doing great. And I'm like, right. No, he's not.
Right.
You know, and the push to, you know, especially at the VA, well, we've got this new trial drug and it probably won't help you. But, you know, if you'd like to try it, you can try it. And my dad's one of those where if a pill can fix me, we're going to take it. We're not going to worry about the side effects and everything, you know. So it's like, no, you really shouldn't. But, you know, so there's that type of a push that anybody who's going through this, I highly suggest somebody goes with them, does the research and asks the questions, even if you're not asking the questions while your loved one is in the room, right? Like you're able to contact them on the phone or, you know, go to another room or something like that, you know, to ask these questions so you don't upset them. Like it's so important to advocate. All right. And let's move on. Go ahead.
Sorry, I was just thinking an answer to Tracy's question. This isn't quite the answer, but I know that there's a blood test that is checking for a specific kind of protein. The thing about that is it's so new. And so people, I don't want people to lose hope. I don't want people to get that, you know, run out and get that blood test and think that they have, you know, Alzheimer's or dementia, and then they just throw up their hands and they're like, okay, well, this is my lot in life. And so, you know, it's just so new. So I would definitely caution on and running out and doing that and leaning more towards lifestyle changes, mm-hmm. nutritional changes.
Yep. I agree, Michelle.
All right. So let's move on to one section that can really help people. There's been a lot of studies done on it. Let's talk about the importance of physical exercise in maintaining those cognitive abilities and increasing that brain function. Bobby, I know you've done quite a bit of research on this, so how about you get us started?
Well, the big thing about exercise is anytime you bring more oxygen and more blood flow to a tissue, it's going to feed that tissue and it's going to elevate that tissue's quality and obviously take away the debris and the garbage that's in that tissue. So what actually elevates your, you know, blood flow in a tissue is getting your heart rate up so that the blood is flowing more and your oxygen is being delivered to those tissues. So what I have kind of started telling people when they're thinking about exercise, because I was actually talking to a client the other day, and she's just like, it's just so hard. I just don't enjoy getting on the treadmill. I just don't enjoy getting sweaty. And I'm like, how about we look at it as movement and oxygenation? Like most people get out of breath when they walk up the stairs. They have to walk up the stairs if they live in a place where there are stairs or they work in a place where there are stairs. So look at things in opportunities for oxygenating your body and moving your blood. Versus, oh, I have to go walk 3 miles on the treadmill or whatever it is that you are dreading to do. So that's what I kind of try to position people to think about. But what they did in the study with Frontier, let's see, it's called International Journal of Environmental Public Health. They did a study of a bunch of older adults and they found that they were able to see an improvement with their cognitive abilities and dementia-related tasks and things that they were scoring higher or lower potentially on when they just exercised 3 days per week and it only needed to be 30 minutes. It didn't have to be for an hour. And it also needed to be not super intense. They just needed to get out of breath. And so if you think of exercise in the form of somebody trying to just do something when they're out of breath, that can really add more to your options, you know, as far as doing things, raking, gardening, those things all count. Playing with your grandkids or kids at the park. You know, I always tell moms, if you're at the park, don't sit on the bench and watch your kids. Get up and move, you know, those kinds of things. So when you look at these studies and you see that the minimal things that they can do actually improve, statistically improve. And one of the things that I also wanted to note is the study also found that the more severe or debilitated the person is, the more significant of gains that they had just by doing the 3 days per week for 30 minutes of some physical activity, which I thought should bring hope to a lot of people that maybe are caring for somebody that's pretty debilitated. You know, being able to get them to go for a walk with you around the park or something like that and get outside, that could be something that could be life-changing for them.
Absolutely. And that's one thing, like with my dad, like he normally just stays at home and watches TV or just, you know, puts around his apartment or whatever, rather than getting out. And that one, a lot of the conversations for me have been, get out, go do something, get social, you know, even if it's just volunteering somewhere or, you know, there's a local golf place that he has gotten a membership to, because he gets a free membership with the VA. So, you know, we're like, fine, go play golf, like get out, even if it's just a couple of days a week to get moving. When you were talking about blood flow, right, like in aging brains, like exercise and what that does, like it gets that blood flow moving. And so I had a question, well, what about nitric oxide? What play does nitric oxide have in this in aging brain? So I looked it up, and as we age, you know, our body decreases in the amount of nitric oxide that it creates and it has, right? And it plays a huge part in neurodegeneration.
So, especially in women.
Yes.
Even more so in women.
Yeah. And so, and nitric oxide is something that you can easily increase as well in your, the foods that you're choosing. So if you eat a lot of beets or beet juice or beetroot powders, stuff like that, and in like your superfood powders, that's why it's in there. Super important to start increasing the nitric oxide in your body. But exercise is the number one way to increase nitric oxide stimulation in your body. So again, that goes hand in hand with the study that you were reading, you know, and it's so important. It doesn't take a lot. You know, at our age, we're like, you know, 30 minutes a day, got to keep it up. But for somebody who is older, said maybe can't get out every single day, doesn't want to get out every just 3 times a week, because it's such a big change.
Well, most seniors, you know, once they get on Medicare, they have opportunities for like Silver Sneakers or other gym memberships, you know, that is included in their insurance and their Medicare. So there are opportunities. Even a little small town I live in, there are several places we can go, the YMCA and a place that's affiliated with the hospital and things like that, that they can go and, you know, like we were saying the other day, the social aspect to it as well, not just the, you know, the movement, but having the social interactions with folks is so important.
Yeah. My father-in-law actually swims. He loves to swim, and he used the Silver Sneakers. He was normally, he lives in Indiana, but he was out in Colorado for many months, and he stopped into a local place and was able to get a very inexpensive Silver Sneakers pass to go swimming. And it really made a big difference for his, not only his physical health, but like you said, his mental health. I mean, he was able to be around people and, you know, be swimming and be social and that kind of stuff. And I think that's huge part of physical. A lot of people look at it as, oh, it's like exercise is like a, I have to do this by myself. And to be honest, the most fun exercise, I don't know about you all, but when I run with somebody or I go to a yoga class or I participate in a group setting, even if it's pickleball, you know, with three other people, it's fun. And that's the part that I would encourage people to do. If they struggle with the whole concept of exercise and sweating and watching the clock and checking their pulse, you don't really need to do any of that. Just get your body moving, get out of breath and sweat. Those are two things.
Yeah. And I think too, you know, having the accountability, even if you're going to a yoga class, which I enjoy, once you've gone a couple of times and you've made friends there, you know, gym, wherever, you know, you feel like, oh, I have to go because they're expecting me, you know, but it's always good to have that accountability partner as well to just keep you motivated.
All right.
I know when I just want to pipe in for a minute for my mother's experience. I know when she was still independent in her 70s and such, and she lived in a town where she had some nice people in her community, and she would go walking a lot, and she'd stop by her friends' houses and have a little lunch and whatnot, and then head on her way and everything. So that, I think that helped her a lot, just to, you know, have that connection.
I wanted to share something really quick that was part of the same study that I was talking about. Is they went through and they went back and they talked a little bit about how physical activity an early intervention, meaning not intervention, but almost teaching, like, you know, when we were kids, we always say this, I know the younger people would be like, yeah, wah. We used to go outside and play. There just literally wasn't as much indoor activity going on as there is today with the internet and, you know, video games and whatever that keep kids inside more. You didn't really have your parents saying, you know, go exercise. That wasn't a part of it. But what the studies found is if kids can actually develop activities that they do as young children, like adolescents and things, it is building like this reservoir or this resiliency in your brain, that it's kind of like building these bridges and these connections that are going to be so much stronger as you age, almost like you're putting money in the bank. So you have more money to pull out potentially as you get older, right? And so midlife too. And they found that in later adults. So they found that exercise, the earlier you start it and move and get in the habit of it, and you guys know this too, once you make a habit of something, like Kathy just said, and you miss it, like if you don't show at yoga, maybe nobody's going to call you up, but you're going to kind of go after a couple times. You're like, dang, I got to get back to that. You know, if your shoes are dusty and you haven't been out for a walk, you get in the habit of it, you start to miss it, and people start to miss you. So the studies really did find that there was compensatory things that your brain was building inside it that were kind of like money in the bank for later. So that if you did experience like a brain injury or a trauma, because trauma, that's one of the things I wanted to also mention, is trauma is detrimental to your brain. And so anybody who's been through traumatic issues, which we've all had trauma in our life, but the ones that really disrupt our brain, you can go back and work on that kind of stuff. And exercise is a huge part of that, helping with that process.
Yeah, I like that analogy that you used and pointed out. I think that was really good. You know, it goes back to a body in motion stays in motion, right? Like a couple episodes ago, we were talking about, you know, the super centarians and centarians are living, you know, like they, a lot of those that were surveyed, but they kept their bodies in motion. They were doing something every single day. And a lot of them living in, you know, these other countries, like that, they didn't have a choice. Like you had to go out and keep doing the things you were doing, gathering food, gathering water, you know, whatever, preparing food for a big family, stuff like that. It kept you moving. And then the social aspect on top of that. Sure. I know near us, you know, we live in the middle of cornfields, but I always notice that the mall, there's always older people who are at the mall, especially during bad weather, and they're walking around and you hear the conversations and they don't necessarily know each other. You know, they're having conversations and they're talking. And then next time, if you go a couple of days later, you'll see the same people. And now they're walking together, right? Like it's just that natural social aspect that comes into play with it, that, you know, our older people generally don't get in anymore because they're retired. And we also have that generation who's starting to go back to work. You know, they're 65 and they can retire, but Social Security disability isn't up. And so now they're getting back into the workforce part-time, which I think sucks, but at the same time, it also keeps them active and it keeps them social and interacting with people. So brain-wise and, you know, mentally, that's a good thing. All right. Well, we have quite a few other things that we're going to talk about. We're going to move those into part two of this, and that's going to be nutrition and brain health, and as well as mental stress, mental, emotional health and stress in concerning brain health. But I wanted to end this session with, does anybody else want to talk about their experience, you know, for our audience that they've had with in their own personal lives with people they know or clients or anything that have gone through this and what they had to witness?
Yeah, I'll pipe in here. So we had a family member who was diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's, and it was very, very young when she was very young. We noticed signs, and I'm talking like late 50s, and she was officially diagnosed at 61 with early onset Alzheimer's. And so just watching the quick decline was incredibly troubling, but also very eye-opening as to how our lifestyle is so critical in how it shapes the development of our brain, because the brain, you know, if we are not getting quality sleep, then that's not giving your brain a chance to repair your cells, all of that. So, and this specific individual, Bobby, you had mentioned trauma, and it is so, so true, because when I started piecing back why, like what in the world happened where it was so early, she was so young, trauma after trauma after trauma after trauma. And then lifestyle, like the woman never drank water ever. And I've become like this water person. Like if you ever listen on the podcast, I say water before coffee, like all the time because it's so critical that we are hydrated. It keeps our cells hydrated. And so she never drank water. You know, her skin was constantly dry. She drank or she ate a ton of sugar. She smoked, you know, like she drank. I mean, lifestyle changes, lifestyle choices, I should say, greatly affected. And lack of exercise, the constant stress she was under, the constant trauma that she had gone through. And it just adds up because, like you said, Shannon, the brain never forgets. And it was just one trauma on top of the other. And at some point, I believe she just kind of threw her hands up and said, whatever. And, you know, whatever is going to be was going to be. And there was no way you could talk her into changes. Now, when she was in the caretaking stage where we were caring for her, I was able to convince her to drink water. I had to sneak it in. I had to trick her. I had to like put the flavorings in. Like I had to, you know, make sure the coffee wasn't ready yet. And then here's a glass of water for you to take your pills with, all that. But, you know, it was such an eye-opening experience for me. And one of the things that I'm actually trying to do now for myself, for my own brain health is, you had mentioned balance, Bobby, too. And that is so critical. I am not only just balance, but using your brain while you're balancing. So like running through some math equations, going over your grocery list, you know, memorizing a scripture verse, like these are things that are actually going to be challenging your brain while you're also balancing, which is also challenging your brain. So that's a really good tool, good exercise to challenge yourself with every single day while you're doing these little quick 4 to 7 minute exercises, or going, if you can't go for a walk, do a little balancing exercises too, because it will go a long way. Because, you know, like we've all experienced, I think it's actually the worst disease, because it just takes away the person that was. And so when you've experienced it, you're in your mind, you're going to do whatever you can to prevent that in the future for yourself and anyone else in your family, and just keep spreading the word to everybody you can talk to.
I agree. Does anybody remember when we're going back now? You can remember phone numbers like back in the day.
Yes, Tracy, I agree with that. Yes.
Like 15 or 16 phone numbers, easily addresses, my friends' addresses, you know, I can nowadays, all of that is through our phone. And just think about it. Do you know your daughter's phone number? Do you know your parents' phone number? Do you know?
But most of us are pen and paper still. Like, we don't even want to do everything digitally online, right?
Yeah. Right. But look how easy, you know, the phones, supposedly smartphones, look what it's doing to us. I mean, there's not much we have to think about doing anymore. So us really being cognizant about that in our daily lives.
Well, the phone's smart, but we're not. I mean,
right.
Let's say that. Yeah. We're getting dumber.
Right. You know, I wanted to piggyback off of what you said, Michelle, as far as balance, right? Like that's another thing to look out for. I know with my father-in-law, he was losing balance. And, you know, he's got fluid buildup around his brain. Doctors don't want to figure out why. Like, they haven't made the attempt to figure out why, you know. They just put a shunt in, let it drain. But these are things that are affecting it. His balance was off. And that's something that can also happen with Alzheimer's and early dementia, especially Parkinson's, right? Like, you have these balance issues. So if you're noticing that, if you're noticing, you know, balance with even just holding spoons or walking, or even the balance in talking, you know, kind of stuttering. It's a big sign. And I think also when we're doing, like we're talking about that pen and paper, right? Like it's those fine motor skills that we also tend to lose when we're older. And so, yes, we can put an app on a phone for one of our parents and tell them, you know, do that for brain training and things. But I think it's also important to let them focus on writing things, drawing pictures. You know, it's like, it's one of the things one of the tests they have to do is to draw. My dad couldn't draw a cube. Well, how often does he write during the day and do something like that? you know? So I think it's really important to take it back to early learning childhood. You know, when we're teaching our babies at ages 1 to 3, all these fine motor skills, that's really where we have to take our parents back to when they get into this. But it's also helping us to recognize what they're losing if they can't do some of these simple.
Yeah, 100%, Shannon. And that's exactly what we would do too. We always gave her notebooks. We, you know, I would help her write letters to people. Yeah, perfect. That's exactly true.
Well, and the balance thing that you brought up too, the back of your brain where your cerebellum is where your balance, a lot of balance is located. And it's the tests, you know, when they do the sobriety tests on the side of the road, they're testing their cerebellum, a lot of the cerebellum, to see if it's under the influence of alcohol. It's one of the quickest ways to kind of do that. And so if you notice yourself losing balance, or you notice, like I was saying, I live on a park. I watch this gentleman. I've known him for quite a while. He's older. He's retired. And I noticed he was shuffling. He was really starting to shuffle. You know, not walk normally, but shuffle. And I was like, gosh, I really hope this person, you know, doesn't have Parkinson's. He used to own a dry cleaners. And so I know he was exposed to a lot of toxins. And he, I don't want to say disappeared for too long, but when he came back, he didn't walk by himself anymore. He now has a spouse or a companion or someone that walks with him because he needs support. And so it's really critical when you're noticing those things in your loved ones or yourself, there are things that you can do. Like you can go in and have MRIs and see where, you know, where's the blood flow not getting in my brain. And so there's different exercises, like you were saying, brain games and things like that. But I'm sure there's cognitive exercises. I know Brain HQ is one that I have personally used. And I've also used to support some of my children with some of the things that they were struggling with. There are ways to improve your brain. My husband actually, after a concussion, had to do some brain retraining. And he was doing this metronome thing where he had to clap really big arm circles and clap on the beat. You know, he will laugh, but he wasn't a person who really had the beat really well. But by the time he was done with this training, he was like, check it out, I got the beat. And he was able to clap on the beat. And that to me, I was like, wow, that's pretty good. You know, I mean, we're in our 50s and he improved his brain. And so if it's that plastic and it can improve, you know, think what it could do for an older person who just maybe spends a little bit of time doing the right things for their brain to improve their quality of life.
Have you taken him dancing yet, Bobby? A little bit bigger challenge.
Very often, but occasionally.
Yeah. Well, I think we have given our audience a lot of great information in that personal connection and personal stories. So to our listeners, stay tuned for part 2 of our brain health episode. It will be coming out next week. And again, we're going to be talking about nutrition and then the mental health portion and stress that affects brain health as well. So hope you all have enjoyed this episode. We've certainly enjoyed bringing you all the information and talking about this and letting you in on a little bit more personal side of us as well. So as always, be well and, you know, take a little trip into your family and some of these things that you may be noticing that we've talked about today. You know, if you have kind of that instinctual gut thing going, I think something's off with mom or dad or an aunt or uncle, you know, hopefully we've given you some information, a little bit of insight to kind of dig in a little bit more. Those gut instincts are usually right. So follow them. That's our North Star tip for this week. Let us know how we can help you. Till then, have a great week and be well, everyone.